class facility, now's your chance. The Museum of Anthropology is located right on campus and free for all UBC students and faculty. Come enjoy our collection and resources.
Do you have an approaching test or exam and need help studying? Well, it's time to prepare yourself. The Study Van, www.studyvan.com, is a 100% free website dedicated to helping you achieve excellence. MCAT, History, Chemistry, French, Math, Biology, the Study Van covers it all. Tools are provided so you can create your own study group and do what you need to do. Ace your exam. The Study Van will help you help yourself. Give it a shot, you have nothing to lose, as once again it is a 100% free studying resource. So remember, when you need to study, go to the Study Van, www.studyban.com.
Do you need someone to talk to? If you are seeking a listener who is non-judgmental, confidential, and familiar with resources, then a Speakeasy volunteer might be able to help you. AMS Speakeasy is a peer support service located in the North Concourse of the Sub. If you would like to speak to someone, come to the desk and tell a volunteer, or ring the doorbell located behind the desk.
Good morning. Welcome to Language to Language. This is your host, Woody Morrison. Kaunsanga iskan kitu kon iskan. In Haida, I have three names. Kaun Tsanga is somebody who brings a special day. Kitu Kun is the butt of the spear. And Kauda Angas, loosely translated, is ugly sit down. But it describes an eagle with wet feathers that let go of a fish that was too large and managed to get ashore and dries feathers off. So that's somebody who knows when to let go. Tsatlanas hat iodi aging. I'm of the Haida Tsatlanas. We have a moiety system, I guess you might call it, in which we're divided between into two groups. Kuala is the population, and so I'm of the eagle side, and the others are ravens. And Tsatlana is a subdivision of the eagle. Tsatlana is the name of a historic place. That's where our crests come from, historic events or historic places, rather than saying there's a spiritual bond between me and that eagle. So Tsetl actually is not an eagle. Tsetl is a Pacific golden plover that in the spring migrates from New Zealand to here in North America, comes across Hawaii and then up around Haida Gwaii and then goes up in the Arctic to nest, and it flies back when the young are strong enough to make the journey. So that's what Tsetl is. Tsetlana Hat Ai is... It's a human. So the word for Haida, Hat-ai, almost sound like you got a real bad hairball, Hat-ai. I'm also from the whale house, the gray whale. My mother's name, Deao Chayang Hinu Hatkil. Virginia Cloud Hino maiden name Kai Laga Hidan. My mother's Haida name was actually a Tlingit name. Chayang means the firstborn. That was my grandfather's mother's name. And my mother was Cherokee from Oklahoma. And so when they did an adoption, my grandfather and his brothers gave her their mother's name. So that was more like they adopted her as their sister when they gave her that name, Chayang. And her maiden name was Virginia Cloud, but she was married to my father, Woodrow Morrison Sr. Wagyan de Hung Hansanon, Woodrow Morrison, Kyagan is Gantla Dai Hatkit Kyagan. So, my father's Haida name was Tladai. Tladai is a big man, but it doesn't really mean so much in a physical sense. He was chief of the Brown Bear House, and to be chief, it doesn't mean that you're bossy, or you can give orders, you're royalty, like the European model. Ours is different. When you become a chief, you wear that hat with the potlatch rings on the top. A stack of those rings resembles the windpipe. And if you see a carving or a drawing of a Haida sea wolf, you'll see that thing coming out of the top of his head. It's segmented. And that's what that is. It's a snorkel, which permits that sea wolf to breathe underwater. And the longer that tube, or the higher the stack of potlatch rings, symbolizes that this person is very deep in the water. And the deeper you get, the greater the pressure becomes from all sides. So you have to become a big person inside. So that's what Tladai is, that big person inside. There's a man in Masset, in Haida, would like to be my father's brother. His name is Claude Jones. He has that same name, Tladai. And so a lot of times these names didn't just give a physical description, but they give more of a description of one's temper, one's demeanor, one's personality. So when children were small, they were watched very carefully to see what their demeanor was going to be, what their temperament. And sometimes, if this child was very kind, very giving, they would refer to this person, this mind is soft. In other words, he approaches everything softly. He doesn't grab things. He pets. He doesn't scream. He cajoles, I guess is the word. If a person is, one guy was skinny, so he was called Skunktung. That means he sniffs at his food before he eats. So you know that this person, you'd never try to make him eat any more than he's eating. He's just going to eat slow and be skinny. And another guy was called Tladals. Tladals means he walks slow. And so it doesn't mean he's slow, you know, mentally, but it just means that he moves through the world with grace, I guess, almost like that. It's just a funny way of walking that guarantees you're going to move slow. I mean, you got to be born with it. It's not something you can just... So anyway, then there was another kind, was called, sometimes I heard them called Skuju. That means he grabs. He's always grabbing. This is a person that's very ambitious, very aggressive. And this was something that was avoided or not wanted in a tribal society. Much like a beehive, if you've got one in there that's going around messing with everybody else's business and pushing everybody around, it upsets the whole harmony of the hive. You know, if you get a wasp in there or hornet, you know, it can kill the others, whatever, but it really doesn't add to the production of the society. And so that's the way this person would be. This person would be a disruptive factor within the social harmony. So once that name was given or that label was put on that person, all the adults, didn't matter which village you come from, if you speak Haida and you understand it, then they would do things to try to... how could they alter this person's perception of themselves rather than being oblivious to the needs and the cares of other people, this one only wants what I want when I want it. And from what I understand, male or female, when this person reached the age of majority, we'll say, or puberty, and they had not been able to alter that view or realign that person's temperament, that person was disposed of. But this is something that took millennia to develop. People didn't simply just say, well, that one's no good, get rid of them. No, people were watched very carefully over the centuries, and they saw when something wasn't right. It was they either tried to change it or they eliminated it. So mental health, I would say, in the tribal societies, was not as prevalent as it is in industrialized societies. For one thing, our definition of somebody with a mental problem, kunungala, that describes a person whose mind permits them to see things that other people can't see. Whereas in the European model, I don't think there's a definition for insanity. It's a judgment call. I don't know what it is. But when you not only keep them alive, but they breed, they pass on these defective genes. And maybe that's what it is. I don't know. But we didn't have stories of men raping women in their own villages or even within their own language group. You know, maybe that happened when they were on a raid with some other people, something. But it didn't happen within our own villages. And if it did, that's an automatic death sentence. If there was incest, the male, we'll say perpetrator, was brought before the boss of the speaking. And they examined the situation, and there was no such thing as not guilty. Either you did it or you didn't. There's no mitigating circumstances. It's either you did or you didn't. And if this person did commit incest, then that person's personal belongings, which nobody really had personal belongings. You make something, you had the first right of refusal type thing. But no person could accumulate a whole bunch of wealth for themselves. But anyway, so whatever his hunting and fishing, whatever implements, and his clothing were taken and burned. And then ceremonially, his name, that man's name, was taken. A hole was dug in the ground, it was put in there and buried, and it was said to putrefy as it should. Then that person was taken to, well, all of our villages were on islands, so they were taken, this person was taken to an island remote from the village, and taken to a large tree. I don't know whether they selected cedar or spruce or hemlock. All I know is I was told it was a large tree. But my assumption was that it was, I always thought it was a spruce tree, because this is where we get medicine for taking care of infections. So this person's arms, he was put face to the tree. His arms were wrapped around the tree as far as he could reach, and then his wrists were tied. His feet weren't tied, just his wrists. Then he was left. And if he could manage to free himself, he could save his life. But Once the name was taken away, he was not only what we call Helena, he was a no name, but they took it one step further. He was invisible. He didn't exist. He was a malevolent spirit, that if anyone set eyes on this malevolent spirit, they had an absolute duty to dispatch it. And so word would go out to other villages and to the other nations that there was a malevolent spirit walking and in the appearance of this person. And so even if that person could move about freely, could not have any contact with any other humans because he would be killed. So that's kind of how you would say we would treat aberrant mental behavior. Was the genes were not permitted to be passed on. If there was a child resulting from that incestuous relationship, I heard that the child was strangled and the body was put into an alder tree. See, the alder is considered to contain the essence of the woman. When a container for drinking water or carrying drinking water, fresh water, was made from the alder, it didn't matter how long that water was in that container, it would never get stagnant, stale. It would stay sweet. And it was said in the springtime, I've never checked it myself, but it said in the springtime, next month, if you go to the alder tree and put your ear to the trunk, you can hear its heartbeat. And so, from my understanding, is that the tree is also my grandmother. It's my relative, that's my grandmother. And so the children were always given to the grandparents to protect them and to show them the proper ways of living. So in a way, to me, I don't know how other people see it, but this is my own personal view, is that the spirit of that little one was given to that grandmother so that the grandmother could take care of it properly, so that it didn't have to end up just wandering and never going home. But this is the way the grandmother could ensure that when this one went home to the village back there, that it went there clean, that there was no taint on this child. So that's what it represented to me, was so you, instead of getting forgiveness, you know, like this is a way in which even after death, the taint could be removed. If it was not the fault of the one tainted, it could be dealt with. But if this person did something that was very heinous and tainted themselves, then that person went to that village back there and had to go through the process. You got a question?
I do. So what would happen, what you described, if someone, you know, committed something that was a heinous crime, let's say, right, and committed incest, and they were now... Let's say they freed themselves from the tree when their wrists were tied. From what I hear, there's no process of like rehabilitation or second chance for that person.
No.
Okay. See, so it is something that's in them, and it won't come out.
Yeah, there was a movie, one of the first action films with martial arts was called Billy Jack. And in there, a woman was raped and he was going to be punished, and Billy Jack said to the woman, "We can't let him get away with it." And she said, "He already has." So he's committed the act, and you can't uncommit the act. If it was truly heinous, then the head would be cut off. And so this is sort of what I see happening. Maybe it's a tribal thing with the ISIS, is that it was said that when the head was removed from the body, that the spirit was then doomed to wander for all eternity. It could never go to that village back there. In other words, it couldn't go to heaven. It wandered for all eternity, sort of a big void out there where the spirit would wander forever. And so that was the ultimate deterrent, was to cut off the head. And people refer to ISIS as this barbaric practice of cutting people's heads off. Well, I don't find that any more barbaric than standing back and blowing somebody's brains out with a gun.
Or a drone.
Yeah, or with a drone. You're not even, that's the ultimate in cold-blooded killing. Because somebody that has no attachment to it gets killed. It's simply collateral damage. Mm. We're sorry, we didn't mean to kill him. But we got the bad guy. Mm-hmm. Oh, great. My children and grandchildren will be real happy now. You know, my wife is gone, and their grandmother will never be around him. So, yeah, to me, that's... And then what's happening here in Canada? It almost seems that Harper wants this stuff to happen. He wants them to come, and he wants this police state. And what people don't get is what they're going to get is that once you put those kinds of laws in, it's called a ratchet effect. Mm. It doesn't ever back down. Mm. You can't go and unfire that gun. But if you watch Harper carefully, that person doesn't seem to have any human feelings. And yet people are willing to debate whether or not we should have more police powers when they've seen these, what do they call them, security, where they can come and get you and throw you in jail and don't have to tell anybody you're there. You don't have to go for a judge. It's a certificate, I think it is. And you can stay for the rest of your life in jail. Nobody knows where you are. You don't have legal counsel, anything. You've already got that. And then... we had one soldier run over by a car, I think, and one shot or something like that. For that, he's going to put that heavy heel on 40 million people. And I just don't understand why people will be so willing to fudge on something like that. When we got no business sending fighter planes, war planes, as people love to call them, war planes and warships, over to another part of the world. To do what? To kill Muslims. They're not, on the other hand, when we talk about these people sending these drones up, they're not radical Christians. Mm-hmm. They're protecting our civilization. People hate us for having our civilization. No, they hate us because we've been running crusades now since the 1200s. Mm. We've been doing it for 1,000 years. And that's why they hate us. The British Empire went in there, and take a look at, your own history of Bangladesh. Countries that were stuck in a Pakistan whose language is closer to India. Mm-hmm. And you take a look at how the countries in the Middle East were all partitioned by the British, and yet that's where all the wars are. And then you listen to stuff with Israel, and the Palestinians are saying, look, we're not going to cooperate with you anymore if you don't start letting us have our tax monies. Millions and millions of dollars they won't give them. To me, that's a bully. Mm-hmm. They got the big gun. They got the nuclear weapons. They've got the fighter planes, missiles. And yet, they're still stomping on somebody. It's sort of like in Haida, that prayer that says, give me the courage to be tall enough to not be small. In other words, my stature is determined by how tall I am, not by how small I make someone else feel or look. And so, to me, that's what it is trying to make somebody else look small, because we feel so small inside, we've got to do that. But Canada, I grew up in the United States, and I would see Canadians overseas. They were treated very, very well. All they had to do was say, I'm Canadian. Somebody say, are you American? No, I'm Canadian. Oh, that's a different thing. But that's changing, because we have a prime minister who wants to be known as a war leader. He didn't pay any attention to all the stuff about our new flag when it came about. I remember seeing that flag on a Canadian ship, where I was on a U.S. Warship. We were running exercises out in the Atlantic with NATO's Operation Steel Pike. And there an oil tanker came alongside us, was flying that flag. That was the first time I'd ever seen the maple leaf. Mm-hmm. And yet, he didn't bother to show up for any of the stuff for it, but he's sure there for the War of 1812, the stuff for World War I and World War II. He doesn't get it. War creates orphans, widows, all those people in the Middle East that are just terribly, terribly torn up. And we're going to create a police state for two people being killed, and yet we're killing and justifying for I don't get it. So anyway, that's my own personal rave or rage, whatever you want to call it. So when we get into these things about law and order, partly what we're dealing with is when we take a look at a cash economy, everything has to do with the bottom line. Everything has to do with profit and loss. Even your social contract has to do with profit and loss. So it's not who's the good guys and who's the bad guys. Who's making us the most money? So when it's determined that you did kill somebody, that you did rape somebody, that you took advantage of a child, and you did it, well, if you're mentally aberrant, well, that's a good reason to get rid of you. You know the movie Catch-22? It took me a while to figure out what Catch-22 was. Well, what it was there's a Regulation 22. And the way it worked, like if a person went to the psychologist, whoever, and said, I can't do this anymore, bombing humans and doing all this thing, that's not a rational thing to do. Well, then this person is sane. But if you go in there, hey, man, I'm digging this. I love blowing up cities and rest of it. Well, they ain't going to send him home because he's nuts. He's doing a good job. So on the one hand, you got to be crazy to go out. But if you're sane, they won't send you out. If you hate war, they won't send. But if you love it, so there was no way to win.
Right.
So you're just stuck in the middle.
That's a good way of looking at it.
So, yeah, when we take a look at our communities, I brought another story in from Robert Kogo's small book, and I wanted to read it. Do you have anything else you want to put on here? Music or? Yeah, just get some. Last week I was at some classes down at Indian Affairs. That's why I wasn't here.
CITR's annual fundraiser kicks off this February 26th at UBC's Pitt Pub. Is CITR your favorite radio station? Do you feel an intense desire to support its continuing mission to provide alternative programming that you literally will not hear anywhere else? Maybe you answered yes. Or maybe you just like to get wild and listen to good music. Either way, this event promises to provide all that and more. Featuring Ace Martins, Atsy, Tits and Bread, Listening Party, and student DJs between bands. Admission is $5 or $3 for CITR members and club affiliates. All proceeds go towards CITR's 2015 fund drive, running from February 26th to March 6th. Of something to happen.
Bye.
Well, this is Woody back again. We're at 101.9 CITR here at University of British Columbia campus at the sub. Anyway, we were talking about a number of things here, and one of the things that passed with almost no notice, there was quite a bit of activity around the Chinese New Year. But something else, on February 21st was the International Mother Tongue Day. This is when we celebrate all our different languages, and we didn't talk about it, we didn't do anything about it, but what I want to do is to put it on my calendar for next year and see if I can talk to some of the First Nations people to start putting that on their calendars, because we have many of our young people talk about my language this, my language that, but if they do know any of the language, many can only greet somebody. Or they say, I only know the bad words. Well, there are no bad words in our language, you know, unless you're just using English equivalent. But anyway, so that went by without much notice. Well, anyway, I've been reading some stories from a small book called Hi to Storytelling Time by Robert Kogo. He was born in a village called Tlinguan. Tlinguan, or in English it's called Tlinquan, was actually where my grandmother was from too, my father's mother. But anyway, this one is called The Great Octopus of North Pass. Haida's stories and tales are not complete without an octopus, or new story, not N-E-W-N-U-W, new story, new stuff. Anyway, this is a story centered at North Pass called Yalk'ik. Yalk'ik'ik is raven, k'i is crab apples, so this was raven's food. At one time, over 1,000 Haidas lived there. This is a family story and has to do with Haida mythology or k'i'gan. I have a copy of the totem, Gya'ang, about 3 feet tall, which was carved by my uncle, my Kadika, John Wallace. John Wallace's name was Sadutz, also of Heidelberg. I have a picture of this model totem, the original, which stood at North Pass Yalk'ik village, or Lana, years ago. All Haida children, Hadla, were taught the strict adherence to the respect of nature and all living creatures on earth. You could not harm or torture anything alive without being paid back in kind. Many things were hana, or taboo. Parents were very strict, seeing to it that hadla, the children, did not break the rules. Any happening in the group was attributed to this, and was taken as punishment. Tlatsis. Now the story is, it was way over there, or long ago, many Haidas lived at Yalk'ik village. Generations of Haidas lived there. The raven, Yash, brown bear, Hoots, clan, was prominent there, as was the eagle, Tzak. Everything was in peace and harmony. There was a time when a raven woman, Yajada, went out on a canoe to gather roots. Time passed and she did not return. A search party found only her empty canoe amongst the inlets in front of the village. At the time, the Indian doctor, Haga, sees that she was taken into the octopus underwater village, and therefore was living there and unable to get back to her village. This myth then became a raven, Yath clan mythology. It was accepted as such, and the clan members' sorrow was eased. As time went on, a group of children, Achadla, were playing on the beach, the Chausali. One of the boys observed a small baby octopus Nu Giti, swimming along the sand beach, Tataja. It was struggling to gain the protection of the rocks, the Kwa. The previous night, the baby octopus had taken on human form and had visited his grandparents. And not knowing what it was, they paid no attention to it. Some of the children playing on the beach had long sticks, skong. They were poking around. Seeing the small octopus, the new Giti gave them a chance to have fun. They forgot all the instructions of their parents. They forgot about things being hana or taboo. They start to flip the small octopus, that new Giti, up on the sand beach, the Taja. The small new Giti was struggling to get back into the salt water, the Chan Sea. Made it back to the octopus world, new Tlagai, octopus world. What was not known is that the small octopus, Nukiti, was a child of the Raven Woman. In the octopus village, Nulana, under the sea, there was trouble. The treatment given to the small octopus became the issue. Octopus people, Nuhatai, demanded restitutions, payment for the wrong done to their grandchild, to their child, their Hadla. The octopus people, Nuhatai, made preparations for an attack on the Haida village, Hadaslana. This is where the Indian doctor, Shaga, comes into the picture. He told of what the children had done. Also, in a dream, he'd seen Raven Woman trying to warn her people. He told of the coming attack on the village. The attack would be on the Raven Clan and their house, Brown Bear House, Hootsnai. It was their children, Achadla, that caused the trouble, Gusua. We must remember there was also the Eagle Clan and their house, Nahalgas, in the village. They were not affected. This Eagle Clan had the frog, Skankustan, on their crest. They were a clan of great hunters and carvers. The Raven chief, Ishlakdas, ordered his clan to make ready for defense. They could not consider the restitution demands. Washlal Ginan of the octopus people. Shaga told them what to do and what to expect. All the seams and cracks in the walls were caulked up. A retainer was put over the smoke hole. The attack would come at night. Shanya. The attack came as expected. A great army of octopus came creeping up all over the beach and up and over the chief's house. They would suffocate the chief and his household. Toward morning, the octopus people could not carry on the attack much longer and they had to retreat back into the bay and salt water. They could not stay out of the salt water for long. The octopus attack had failed and the chief and his house were saved. To commemorate this event, the chief gave a big potlatch with Shlal. It calmed hard feelings besides giving stature to the Raven House, the Raven Woman, and her children. This being our clan mythology, I have a model totem of the one that was erected at this potlatch. This model was carved by John Wallace, who is my uncle, and one of the last great Haida carvers. His name is Sadoots. And this is the end of the story. Tlan Gyatlangai Hidang. You know, this place, North Pass, Yeshkik, there's a large boulder that stands maybe 10 feet high, and it's coal black, and it looks like a sculptor went in and carved a raven out of that big black rock. And so this is said that this is where Raven dwelled during that time when Raven was doing all these wondrous things. My younger brother and I used to beachcomb for deer there and go through that pass. And one morning, there's one part of the pass on the western end of it that's very narrow and it's shallow. Well, we were on a wooden skiff, a 16-foot length wooden skiff my father had built, and we had, I think, a 15-horse outboard Johnson motor. And as we were nearing that pass, I saw a large, you know, water, big splash, just a few feet out from the shore where there's a rock outcropping. So I slowed down, and it came up again, and something was thrashing, and then went back underwater. As we got closer, it came up again. And what it was a harbor seal with an octopus covering its snout. And the octopus was trying to drown it, and it would force its way to the surface to try to breathe. But the octopus did drown it. Seals are very curious. And so maybe what happened was that seal stuck its nose in the opening to that octopus house we call Nunai. You can see where the octopus lives because in front of the opening to this octopus den or house, it's all these pieces of clamshells. The octopus eats shellfish, and it has a beak, much like a parrot, in which it can crush those shells and then eat the clam out of it. And so maybe that's what that seal was attracted to, but that octopus did drown it. And about maybe 5 miles from there to the west is another place called Hek Inwai Kun. Hek is a halibut, Inwai is half, Kun is nose. So when you go by that point, it's called Halibut Nose, at the base of the cliff, there's sort of a shelf with a rock on top of it that looks like the nose half of a halibut. It looks just a perfect shape. And it's said that a killer whale got a hold of a large halibut. And when they shake their head, that's how they'll cut through. A shark does the same thing. It shook its head and the nose half of the halibut tore off and landed on that shelf and it became stone. But anyway, that same area, when I was a kid, traveling with my father on his fishing boat, we were going by there, and there were some other boats there drifting, and there was a big splash, this whale come out of the water, and there was a giant octopus on its back. See, the Pacific giant octopus, I've seen those things, you know, 15 feet long. And they don't bother anybody. Sometimes we catch them on our halibut gear. But anyway, that octopus was over the spout hole on that whale, you know, trying to drown him, I guess. But that whale swam right at the cliff. There's a rock cliff. Then roll on its side and like it's trying to scrape that octopus off. And the octopus would slide, say, if the whale turned over on its right side with its back to that cliff, that octopus would slide over to be on top of it, you know. And as soon as the whale would right itself, it would slide back to try to get over. This went on for a couple of days. I wasn't there, so I don't know what the outcome was. I don't know if anybody knows what the outcome was. But it was that same area where we see killer whales would attack a whale. And they didn't eat the whole thing. They went for the jaw. And the old man told me that it goes for the tongue. I don't know if there's a real tongue inside, but there's a part where the baleen is, I guess, down in the throat. And that's what they would go after. And sharks, I guess, would come along and finish off the rest of it. But they would get get these big sea lions too. You know, sea lions weigh a couple, at least a ton, these big ones. And I guess it's a herd of these big sea lions going through. It's the current's very strong. We call it Chutzik, or the Chinook word Skookumchuck. There's one here too, but one in Alaska. Anyway, those big sea lions, they came in. They're coming in from the ocean. They're coming inside the islands, following the feed, you know, herring usually. And there were big whirlpools. It was really quite amusing to watch a big sea lion get into one of those whirlpools and then disappear down in it. And then you sit and watch. Sometimes it took quite a while, you know, a few minutes more. And suddenly this huge sea lion would come shooting completely out of the water, you know. You could see the water boiling up because, you know, the current would, the water was going down in that whirlpool, and then it comes up somewhere else, that energy, and that's what those sea lions would go down in there, and they would come up and go flying around 10 feet in the air, you know. And look like they're having a great time playing in that. But we fished halibut in there too, my father and I and my younger brother. And we were doing what's called hand lining. You take a halibut skate, it's, we'll say, 60 fathoms long, a small skate. There's 6 feet to a fathom, so this thing's 360 feet long. And then the hooks are spaced, I guess, about every 12 feet, every two fathoms. And so there's a little loop on that, what we call the ground line, and then the hook had it was... Oh, I guess it's about 2 feet long, a piece of line attached to the hook. And then you tie that hook to it's called a ganyon. Would go through that loop or becket and tie it on. So you could actually untie the hooks from it when you didn't have to have them in there all the time. But anyway, so we'd set the gear, and we used 35-pound anchors because the tide was quite strong. We'd set the gear and then let it sit for 6 hours because the tide would run one direction. And then when we have what they call skagastlu is when the tide is slack. It's not. We'd have about half an hour to go out and pull that gear by hand. And my dad, I was, you know, a skinny kid, about 12 years old. My dad would pull the anchor, you know, that part of it. And then I would pull the ground line, and my brother would steer the 16-foot boat at a little inboard 25-horse engine in there. And so my brother would go along the line as I'm pulling, and he's following that gear. And then when halibut would come up on the line, then my dad would step over and help me. We were pulling that one day. I was pulling. And I told my dad, I said, gee, I think it's snagged on the bottom or something. It feels so too heavy, I can't hardly pull. He said, well, keep pulling. So I did. And then I looked like the bottom of the ocean was coming up. And I told my dad, I said, Dad, look at that. And he said, here, he said, I'll take the line, get the gun. We had a .22 rifle. And so when this halibut came up, just as it come out of the water, if you look at the side of a halibut, there's a line that goes down the center of the body. See, the halibut's mouth is on his side, and both eyes are on top. But that line comes up toward the head and then makes a slight hook. And right where that hook is where the sort of the joint between the head and the backbone is. And so that's where you shoot it. And so just one shot, you know. But this thing was so big that we had to put a line through the gills and tow it. We couldn't pull it in the boat. But we got two like that. And then we went back to Dad's big boat, the 48-footer, and used a winch and block and tackle to hoist these two fish aboard. And so we dressed them and weighed them, and both of them weighed 310 pounds each. So these were huge halibut we pulled out of there. And one day I was pulling, and I said, "Dad, look at that starfish." I looked down, and he started laughing. Here it was one of those giant octopus. But its tentacles were all sticking out in a direction like a starfish. And the thing was coming up like that. And as it got close, Dad said, "You got to pull real fast when it gets close to the surface, because if you're not fast enough, it'll swing so that it'll get on the bottom of the boat, and you can't pull it loose." And sure enough, that's what it did. It swung underneath the boat. And, you know, you could see the tentacles on both sides of the boat. The boat was only about 6-8 feet wide. And, you know, you could see the tentacles. It wasn't big enough to take the boat down, but it was enough to, you know, scare me pretty good. My brother was younger, and he wanted to see, but he couldn't. He had to steer the boat. And finally, my dad just cut the line, you know, cut that ganyon, because there was no way we could pull that hook loose, and just left it there, and finally it just let go and sunk back down.
It was a calamari.
The first time I saw a calamari, I had no idea what it was. Where I came here to Vancouver for Expo 86, and there's a whole bunch of hiatus, and somebody lived here in Vancouver. Said, "Let's go get something to eat." So we all took off and went someplace, and I had no idea what they were ordering. I'd been around the world a little bit, but I had no idea what that was. And I thought, it kind of looked like small little onion rings, but they're kind of gummy. So it's still not one of my favorite foods. But geez, looked like I talked our way clear through this thing. You know, when we talk about our traditional ways of dealing with imbalance, you know, the whole thing is, how do you keep the society balanced so that we're social beings? We need other people. We need to be around people. And so if somebody is disrupting all that harmony, it causes a great deal of pain for many, many people. So societies used to be geared toward maintaining that harmony rather than law and order, because law and order is very oppressive. This is where somebody's going to beat you down, whatever, to beat you into line so that you're marching to the same drum, I guess it is. So when we hear our politicians talk about this thing about having to get more power to the spy agency and to our police, hell, you already got them driving armored personnel carriers and stuff like that. You know, what else do you... But once you get that line, you can't get rid of it. So you're stuck with it. So I would say proceed with caution. If I get a chance to vote on it, I'm going to vote no. Early and often. So anyway, thanks for coming and visit with us today. So I'll see you next week, and we'll try to bring something else different in next week. It has to do with financing education.
I don't know if I've ever told this story.
In the late 80s and early 90s, a couple of well-known criminologists started making predictions about a wave of super predators.
By the year 2005, we may very well have a bloodbath of teenage violence.
There was a group of guys at the group home, and they were like, "You need a car for school. We can go steal this car."
They drove to a dirt road. They put me in the trunk, and I had tape over my eyes, and I can't even describe the emotions when you actually realize that somebody is trying to kill you.
I got charged with attempted murder, conspiracy to commit murder, robbery, conspiracy to commit robbery, kidnapping, conspiracy to commit kidnapping. They were sending me to the adult system at 13 years old.
And then they ask you these questions. "So do you understand what you're losing?" I wish I could go back in time as an adult and be like, "Are you f***ing kidding me?" My lawyer just told me to answer yes to that question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Next Wednesday, listen to Super Predators Revisited, the first in a series brought to you by the University of Washington Center for Human Rights and CITED, a brand new podcast about the stakes of academic research. CITED airs each and every Wednesday on CITR at 11:30 a.m. Visit CITEDpodcast.com and subscribe to CITED Podcast on iTunes to hear the whole series.
I'm Marie Bernard, host of Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. Join me Mondays at noon as we explore the universal energy that connects us all. Let's discuss our journey of self-discovery, joy, presence, and living with authenticity. We can create positive change in the world, and it starts within each one of us. Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. Mondays at noon on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Hello, good afternoon. Welcome to Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard, and it is a beautiful day in Vancouver. I'm super excited. I always say I'm super excited, but I'm really enthusiastically excited today about our guest, Dr. Stan Tatkin. He's been on the show before, and he is the author of Wired for Love, Your Brain on Love, and Love and War in Intimate Relationships. And he's also working on a dating book right now. And he has a clinical practice in Southern California. He teaches at Kaiser Permanente, and he's an assistant clinical professor at UCLA. And he also developed the psychobiological approach to couple therapy. Together with his wife, they founded the PACT Institute, and we're going to be talking about his couple therapy, what is a psychobiological approach to that. And if you have a question and you want to get on the air and ask it, the number is 604-822-2487. Welcome to the show, Stan.
Hi, Marie. How are you?
I am wonderful. I'm so happy that it all worked out.
I am too. I'm very happy.
Yay.
And I'm glad you have good weather there.
Yes, it's been really nice. We're really lucky. So maybe for people who haven't heard your previous interview, just for our education, could you tell us a little bit about what it means to a psychobiological approach to couple therapy?
Yeah, it's a mouthful, isn't it? What psychobiology means, basically, is that we're looking at the whole person developmentally, brain development, nervous system development, and from a psychological point of view. So it really combines more than just psychology. We're looking at faces, eyes, movement, skin color, voice, all that stuff. Basically observing the human animal.
Awesome.
If that makes sense.
It does. And I've listened to Wired for Love, and I've read Your Brain on Love, or is it the opposite? The book?
they all seem to have brain in them. Yeah. Love and War, Wired for Love, and Your Brain on Love. Yeah.
Yes. So I've read and listened to two of those. I haven't read Love and War yet, but I'll have to pick that one up as well. And so I'm curious about how the approach to therapy works. So what does it look like if a couple goes into your office for this type of therapy for the first time?
Well, with me in particular, people, the first time we meet for 3 hours, we're all on chairs that wheel, not on stationary furniture. I use videotape because a lot of this research involves what's called a frame analysis, where we're looking frame by frame at people's behavior, faces, and so on. And a lot of this is played back to the couple, not all of it, but some is played back. And so were you saying something? Did I interrupt you?
Nope.
Okay, I thought I heard. And so we work basically by listening to what people are saying, but we're more interested in what people are doing, what their bodies are doing. And the reason we do that is because as PACT therapists, we understand how the brain works and how processing of information works. And that is that we react and act by memory on a somatic level, on a body level, and that really is more, that expresses more of the truth than words.